You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Nationals reporter Jamal Collier. A Valentine's Day edition of the podcast, and beyond Valentine's Day, it's also pitchers and catchers reporting to not Vieira, Florida, but West Palm Beach, Florida, and the Nationals' new facility down there. So let's start there, Jamal, because when we talked about the facility before, you hadn't been there yet, but now you're there, and I know there's some construction still going on, but what are your first impressions?
Looks really nice. I mean, it's really, I think somebody compared it earlier and said it's kind of like one of the stadiums in Phoenix. And, you know, obviously those stadiums are all much newer than some of the things that they have here in Florida, but it's really a great facility. There's still like some things that have to get done, get finished, that they'll be working up until games start here, I believe, on the 28th. But, you know, as far as right now, what they need to get done to get work in, it looks really good. We got the tour of you know, one of the bullpen stations where they have somewhere between 12 and 20. No one's entirely sure exactly how many bullpens they have, which was kind of funny. But, you know, 12 or so bullpens lined up in a row. They've got an agility field. They're going to get a chance to do a lot of different things on. The batting cages are huge. Just a great, the clubhouse looks different. The players are very happy about that. Looks great. So it's a nice facility here in one of the, you know, one of the better spring training facilities here in Florida that the Nats are pretty excited about.
Yeah, and it's nice that they're around other teams as well, and the travel will certainly be better for the club this spring also. All right, so not a lot of players talking, I guess, today, but Dusty spoke. So what did you learn from Dusty Baker today at camp?
Yeah, a couple of different things. Year two for Dusty coming in, obviously. You know, we talked about just kind of how it's going to be an easier season or spring for him. You know, he's still obviously got a couple of changes, but with this team mostly having the same guys back, there's not that big of a learning curve. That need to kind of have to figure out half your team as opposed to think about what guys you want to keep or what guys you want to have in certain roles. So I think the biggest thing for Dusty this year, one, he talked about his future. And right now he's only got the 1 year left on his contract. He said, look, as far as lame duck, and I know that's something that some managers aren't comfortable with or they really want to get this done, you know, he kind of made the joke that, hey, I've been in this situation before. I'm way past lame duck, way past lame at this point. So, you know, he thinks he would like to keep managing. He would like to get something done. But as far as this, it's not something he's concerned about. You know, he talked just, again, the ninth inning's been the big question for the Mavs, and he kind of went a little bit more into that and just maybe some of the health of his starting pitchers. But, you know, Dusty's kind of ready to get going here for year two, which he thinks is going to be a really good ball club.
Yeah, it's win now time, so no need to think too much about the future, I guess. You mentioned the bullpen, the ninth inning, and obviously that's going to be an ongoing story, I guess, throughout the spring, and it's been a big story throughout the offseason for this team, and that's one of the spots we still have to touch on as we make it around the roster here for the Nationals. So today's a good day to cover the bullpen, and the one thing missing there from the bullpen is the big free agent signing that we thought might come. So as you look at it now with pitchers and catchers reporting, Jamal, what is your best speculation as to who wins out and gets that ninth inning role?
Well, I mean, with the two guys, I think, who are the kind of early camp favorites are Sean Kelly and Blake Treinen. I think with Sean Kelly, he was so good last year in the eighth inning and just so effective, probably one of the most, you know, 10 or 15 most effective relief pitchers in baseball. You look at just some of the numbers that he had, probably was his best season. I think that puts him there. The question mark with him, of course, is durability and his health. He's a guy who's had two Tommy John surgeries, a guy who the Nets don't really like to extend and push if they can avoid it. And it's a guy that are you comfortable putting him in a closer role? You may have to use him 3 days in a row or four out of five. And they just are not sure exactly what kind of limitations they would put on him. And they're not sure they want to put him in that particular stressful of a role. On the other hand is Blake Treinen, a guy who also made a huge step forward last year. After, you know, struggling and being in the minors, as a matter of fact, the year before, he was one of their best relief pitchers. The sinker was deadly. He was able to get ground ball double plays and get out of a lot of jams for them. So, you know, for me, the makeup there is not a question because he's a guy who came into big spots and got them out of jams last year. The question is a guy, again, he's never done it, and he's still very young, and he's had problems getting out lefties before. And to kind of necessarily throw him into this role that, you know, is going to be so unfamiliar for him, you're just not sure how he's going to respond. So those are probably the two guys in camp, but, I mean, the way it sounds and the way it seems, they're still looking at their options. And I think just a signal, even of the day before, you know, Monday, when they, you know, went out and made the signing of Adam Lim, I don't think that they're done with this roster just yet. I think they're going to still be looking for whatever tweaks or things they can necessarily do of leading up until opening day here. And I still think there's a chance to go out and acquire somebody here before we really get rolling here in April.
Yeah, and Lynn's certainly a nice addition, you know, some security certainly for Ryan Zimmerman over at first base, maybe even a platoon situation there. We also heard, besides that signing on Monday, there were rumors over the weekend even of the David Robertson addition, yep. Kind of those rumors kind of stirring up again with the White Sox. Sounded like maybe it was heading in the right direction, and then that it was stalemated. There's still a lot of spring to go. Is that something that could still happen?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think, again, these sides have kind of re-engaged these talks a couple of different times here now through the offseason. I think as we get closer, again, to the season starting, and the White Sox may have a more desire to unload them, and the Nets may look at what they have in-house and say we really need to go out and make some kind of move here. So I think it's still at this point they have not been able to reach an agreement, Aaron. It's been a couple of months, but I still think they're going to talk and try to figure something out to see if they can get this done. It does make a lot of sense for both sides.
Yeah, and the fact that they're still talking after all this time makes you think that really deep down inside both teams want to make it happen. It's just a factor of making it happen. All right. Beyond Kelly and Trinan, who can battle it out there, ninth inning, eighth inning, they're going to be late inning guys for this team. I feel like the bullpen can be split up as into there's some veteran guys, there's some young guys coming up. You have Oliver Perez, Samuel Solis. Where do those kind of veteran guys fit in?
Yeah, and that's also kind of the things that they're going to be a little flexible with. I mean, they at times last year carried three lefties. Perez and Solis are probably both definitely in. But, you know, Dusty, I think, likes the idea of having a third lefty to give him just flexibility to do things and match up earlier in games than he normally would. You know, on the other hand, with that, you have, you know, a guy like Joe Nathan, and a veteran coming in on a minor league invite that Dusty was pretty intrigued by, one of the few guys he kind of named individually, you know, of his kind of minor league group as a guy who, one, has closing experience, and a guy who, if depending on what he has left in the tank, which still remains to be seen what it is at 42 years old, that he could have a chance to kind of find himself into some kind of late inning role. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch that really there are probably about four spots taken up in this pen between, you know, the guys we just talked about, that'd be Kelly, Trinan, Solis, and Oliver Perez. But that probably leaves about at least three spots open, you know, three or four spots to be filled out here to figure out exactly who, you know, and Coda Glover is another guy who was very impressive for them as a young pitcher last year, coming up, really started in low A ball and kind of made his way to the majors. It was really impressive. He got hurt, had a torn labrum in his hip. That kind of derailed his season there, but they like him. They've continually said over and over that he's a future closer. So, I mean, he's a guy who also is going to be into that mix and with a strong spring. Could find himself into one of those late inning options. So there is some uncertainty in the bullpen, but there also are some good options that they feel pretty good about right now.
Yeah, Glover was one of the young guys I was going to mention, obviously coming off the injury. Trevor Gott, another guy who battled injuries last season, was very effective in 2015, I think, where he made his debut, I believe, in the majors. What's the story with Trevor Gott at this point heading into spring training?
Yeah, another guy they really like. He was the last reliever cut last year to not make the bullpen. Then, of course, the injuries kind of set him back. Then the bullpen was just kind of good, and there wasn't a spot for him. But, you know, he's a guy that if he's going to throw upper 90s and you know, have some good off-speed stuff to work off that, he's still developing those things. But, you know, he's a guy they like a lot, and a guy that I think also is going to have be pushing to make this bullpen as well. You know, again, when they acquired him from the Angels a couple of an offseason ago, they had high hopes for him, and I think that nothing they saw last year kind of changed that.
So I know fans expected to see this team go out and make a move to help out that bullpen, but as you see, there are options there. There's guys that they can turn to. We mentioned Adam Lind a little bit earlier. Did Dusty speak at all about that addition today when he spoke? And does this add any pressure to Ryan Zimmerman as far as the spring goes?
You know, Dusty didn't speak about him yet. The deal isn't official just yet.
Right.
Should be in the next day or so here that kind of gets done. But I don't think it does anything necessarily to Ryan Zimmerman. If anything, it could potentially help maybe take some pressure off Zimmerman just in the case that, you know, they have and Quentin Robinson did some really good things for them as a backup first baseman last year in the last couple of years. But, you know, with a guy like Lynn who started and had success in the majors, you know, you can afford to give them some days off maybe more frequently than they did before. As a guy that maybe they, if he is ailing with something and they just don't want to push it, they feel real comfortable with having Lynn spell him or Jason Worth out of left field. So I think that it could end up helping. I think, again, they've been very, very firm about that Ryan Zimmerman is going to be the starting first baseman, and they weren't interested in necessarily going out and finding another option there. So I think Zim's hold on that position is going to be kind of on lock here. But I think that they're going to try to use Lynn and try to be just the way they've done things with Zim, especially the last couple of years, to try to be smart about, you know, keeping him healthy and keeping his innings using his innings in a smart way, not necessarily burning him out. So I think Lynn has a chance to increase, you know, the rest that Zim can necessarily get for him.
Great stuff, Jamal. Hey, stay safe with the hard helmet on there with the construction going on in West Palm Beach. I know the facility is going to be spectacular once it's all finished up and done. That's going to do it for MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with Anthony DiComo, our MLB.com Mets reporter, who is in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Pitchers and catchers have reported for the New York Mets as spring training is underway on the eastern side of the state of Florida. So, Anthony, I guess, first of all, first impressions. It's a place you're very familiar with, obviously, years of covering this team in spring training. What's the vibe like after a couple of days? I know the whole roster's not there yet.
Yeah, it's a place I'm very familiar with. It's a team I'm very familiar with. The entire 40-man roster, really with the exception of Bartolo Colon, is here from last year, is the same. The Mets didn't add anyone from another team to the 40-man coming into this season, which is pretty rare in baseball. It's pretty rare in all sports. Terry Collins touched on it when he got here and said, I really don't need to introduce myself to anyone around here. I know these guys all already. I've managed them all already. So that's definitely a comfort level for the Mets coming in. And, yeah, it kind of helps them get down business as usual. Another spring in Port St. Lucie, a longer spring in Port St. Lucie with the World Baseball Classic and a lot of guys leaving to participate in that. So that'll break it up a little bit. But it is business as usual for a Mets team that, as we know, as we've talked about many times on this podcast, has very high aspirations going into the 2017 season.
And we're going to get into that rotation a little bit here on the podcast as we continue to go position by position. But before we get to the starters, Jairice Familia had a few issues just as far as getting into the country, which happens every spring for different players, just a matter of work visas and working through that stuff. But he's now there. Did he speak at all about his you know, thoughts on the upcoming season? Obviously, there's possibly a suspension coming.
Yeah, he did. Jairice Familia arrived in Port St. Lucie. He reported to the complex on Tuesday morning, and he did field questions from reporters. Wasn't willing to get into anything involving that arrest back in October on a domestic violence charge. Said his lawyers advised him to talk about anything revolving around it. So he kind of stuck to baseball topics. Said he's excited to be here. Said that he's excited to pitch for the Dominican in the World Baseball Classic. He pitched in winter ball down there in the Dominican. So he's in good shape. He's in good spirits. As far as the suspension goes, the Mets and Familia both are kind of in wait-and-see mode. I think everyone around here, if you talk to, is kind of operating under the assumption that Jairice Familia will receive some sort of suspension from Major League Baseball, but no one really knows how long it might be or if it'll happen at all. These are very much case-by-case things as MLB tackles them. We've seen it a couple times here, whether it's Jose Reyes or Aroldis Chapman, receiving different sorts of suspensions from Major League Baseball. And every case is truly different. So the Mets are operating under the assumption that Familia will be suspended, but they really don't know, and they don't expect to find out for at least another couple of weeks as we get closer to the season.
All right, let's move on to the starters, who obviously would be the backbone of this team. And if they're going to go back to the World Series, it's going to be this starting rotation that takes them there. And the four guys, you know, are kind of set. As long as they all stay healthy, you have Noah Syndergaard, Jacob deGrom, Matt Harvey, Steven Matz. There'll be a battle for that fifth spot during the spring. Let's start with Syndergaard, who apparently, Anthony, put on 15 pounds of muscle and thinks he can actually throw harder in 2017. I'm not sure if that's a good idea or not for him to throw harder, but it's certainly for a guy who's tall, lanky a little bit, putting on a little added muscle is probably a good thing as far as durability over the course of 162 games.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you there, Tim. I'm not sure if I would ever refer to Noah Syndergaard as lanky. even last year, he definitely packed some muscle on that body, and it's a big one. Yeah, you know, I think Noah Syndergaard coming to camp and saying he wants to throw harder is a little bit of bluster, is a little bit of who this guy is and kind of that outsized image we all have of Noah Syndergaard. He says he spent his winter eating venison, eating deer meat, as part of this protein-packed bowl that he would eat every day down there in Texas. So it's kind of a funky part of his personality. And I'm with you. I'm not sure throwing harder is necessarily a good thing for the hardest throwing starting pitcher in baseball, especially considering all the injuries we see across the sport. But look, this is a guy, I think we forget sometimes how young he is and how in some ways he's still growing into this body that's relatively new to him. He's still growing into being a pitcher at the big league level, and it's scary to say, and it's almost a little bit ludicrous to say, but this is a guy that still has room for improvement. You know, he still has room to grow into not just a Cy Young candidate, but a Cy Young winner. He has room to grow into being essentially the best pitcher in baseball. That is his ceiling. That's what the Mets hope for him. They hope he can use that big body and undergo an ace-type load, a 220-inning type output, and really become the stopper, the number one, the absolutely everything on this Mets staff. And if he can do that, then things look even that much rosier for this starting rotation. So whether or not Noah Syndergaard goes out there and starts throwing 103 this season instead of 101, I'll believe it when I see it. But the Mets certainly have high expectations for Noah Syndergaard, and obviously Noah Syndergaard has high expectations for himself.
When you look at the big four, obviously Matt Harvey is coming off the most serious of the injuries with the surgery and a lot of rehab in the offseason. Where is he at right now? And I know he spoke. He seems confident that he can get back to being a ace-type pitcher.
Yeah, Matt Harvey's always confident. And, you know, where he's at, I think with him and with a lot of these guys, while they express this confidence and while they all say they're kind of on a normal program for the most part and have had normal off seasons and all that, it's kind of let's get them out here and let's get them throwing some live BP and let's get them eventually into games here at the end of February and into March, and then we'll see. This is, as I said earlier, a nice long spring for the Mets and for every team with the World Baseball Classic, and it gives guys who aren't playing, such as Matt Harvey, the chance to ease into their spring routines maybe a little bit more than they otherwise would. This isn't a Tommy John surgery where it happens every year into so many pitchers around baseball and that it almost becomes routine, or at least as routine as a surgical procedure can. This is removing a rib from his torso to repair something called thoracic outlet syndrome, which is a kind of a serious condition, compressing nerves, restricting essentially the things that the human body needs to do to function. So it was a scary thing that Matt Harvey went through last year. He admits in retrospect that there was some worry, there was some concern over his future, mostly because he didn't know what was wrong. Now he knows what was wrong. He had it fixed, and he has reason to believe from what the surgeons have told him, from what the doctors have told him, that you know he's going to be good this year. He's going to be a normal pitcher. And is that a return to 2013 Matt Harvey when he was dominant, when he was a top five pitcher in baseball? I think that's asking a lot. But if Matt Harvey can go out there and give you 180-plus innings and essentially be that guy that you know he can be when he's healthy, then you start worrying about the ceiling and thinking about how good can this guy be again. I think for now, at the start of spring training, the Mets are simply looking at Matt Harvey as, well, let's get him on the mound, let's get him throwing, let's see how healthy he is, and hopefully for the Mets' sake, he stays healthy throughout the summer and really adds something productive to this team.
And then it's a common theme, but then you have DeGrom and Matt, similar stories, not as serious as far as their injuries go, but two other guys that are, I think, pretty much in the right spot, like you said, getting ready for spring training. But do they treat this spring any differently than past springs coming off of seasons with injuries?
I think throughout Mets camp, and that goes for Jacob DeGrom and Steven Matz, it goes for Matt Harvey, it even goes for someone who's been healthy like Noah Syndergaard. I think there is a certain amount of caution the Mets are going to use with all of these pitchers. You know, these guys out here in the early days of spring training, they do their PFTs, their fielding drills, and it's the most boring thing in the world. Any one of them will tell you. Every team does it. And, you know, instead of throwing to bases and instead of throwing home this year, the Mets aren't even using baseballs. They're going through the motions, but they're not actually throwing balls. And that's just one example, one little step of little things along the way that the Mets are going to try to do just to limit the strain on these guys' arms. You know, they're not going to play catch at the beginning of their workouts. They're going to do it at the end when they're already kind of warmed up this year. On days when they're not supposed to throw, a lot of these guys won't play catch at all when they're not supposed to throw off the mound, and they'll just limit their arm in that way. And then obviously once we get into the season, the Mets are going to look, as they did last year, at skipping starts, at maybe inserting a sixth guy into the rotation every once in a while, just to, again, limit the strain that is on these arms. Because even a guy like Jacob deGrom, yes, he had surgery to move a nerve in his arm, but even before that, he had had little things with his health here and there, things that cost him a start, things that cost him a week or two. And Steven Matz certainly has a long, lengthy injury history. So while his surgery to remove a bone spur is one of the mildest operations a pitcher can have, you look at the greater body, you look at everything that's been going on in the past couple of years, and Steven Matz has had all sorts of aches and pains in his arm ever since the day he was drafted. So I don't think the Mets are taking anything at all for granted with the health of these guys, with any of these pitchers. And again, the great hope is for every single one of them to stay in the rotation. The Mets know that's not going to happen. It doesn't happen for any team. It's just not something that happens around baseball. It's the nature of pitching. But as much as you can minimize the injuries, as much as you can minimize the time that these guys lose to the disabled list or even something more minor than that, for a team built around starting pitching, it's absolutely everything.
And that brings us to the fifth starter spot, which will be one of the intriguing things of this spring as far as the Mets go, and a team that's pretty much set most of the way around the diamond. But you have Zach Wheeler, who is supposed to be one of these five guys, five aces in the Mets staff, but he's basically missed two seasons. So he comes back, and then you have Robert Gsellman and Seth Lugo, who were both really good helping the Mets get back to the postseason late last season. Is this just an open battle for these three guys? And you mentioned starting a sixth pitcher at times. They certainly have the depth to do that. But is it an open battle for that fifth spot?
Yeah, the Mets are certainly painting it that way. And I think it's not only one of the most interesting roster battles here at Mets camp, I think it's one of the most interesting roster battles around baseball. Because you do have Zach Wheeler, who had some big league success before his Tommy John surgery, was one of the most heralded pitching prospects in the entire game not that long ago. Obviously throws hard, obviously has great stuff, but like you said, has not been in the league for 2 years, has had a lot of trouble coming back from Tommy John surgery. And you know, pitchers take it for granted that 12 to 15, maybe 18-month timetable. Zach Wheeler has blown by all of that and still has not gotten back on the mound. So until we see it, until the Mets see it, it's going to be something that's in the back of everyone's mind is, can this guy stay healthy? And even if he can, you look at what else the Mets have. How do you tell Robert Gsellman, who was really one of the better pitchers in baseball down the stretch last season, helped pitch the Mets into the playoffs, into that National League wildcard game, how do you tell him that he doesn't have a job in the rotation because someone who hasn't pitched in the big league since 2014 is coming back? You know, it's a hard sell. And I think certainly at the very least, Robert Gsellman deserves to have a shot to compete for this thing. And same with Seth Lugo. Well, he might not have the eye-popping stuff that a Gsellman has or that a Wheeler has. He had every bit the amount of success that those guys had on the mounds down the stretch in 2016. So he, too, I think, deserves a shot to compete at this thing. And the Mets will let them compete. There aren't spots for all of them. And I think ultimately maybe one of those guys ends up in the rotation, one of those guys ends up in the bullpen, and one of them ends up in AAA to stay stretched out in case the Mets do need a sixth starter at some point early in the season. It's a fascinating battle. Three really talented guys coming from three kind of different positions of basically just where their careers have taken them. And it's definitely going to be one to watch throughout the spring. I think, you know, the guy who has the most success and the Grapefruit League doesn't always win these roster battles. In this case, I think that very well may be the case.
And if you're the New York Mets, this is a good problem to have and an exciting thing to watch. All right, this has been MLB.com Extras, our Mets edition. For Anthony DiComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Marlins reporter Joe Fusaro. Today on the podcast, we will finish off our positional rankings. We'll go through the outfield of the Marlins. and break that down. But before that, some news as far as the team goes this week. David Sampson speaking earlier in the week as the team reports to spring training about some different things. A lot of it financial as well, Joe, when you talk about ballpark naming rights and updating a TV deal. Obviously, these are things that go towards being able to spend more on a roster and be competitive. It sounds like the big plan is to have a new name for the ballpark in place, at least by the All-Star break. Is that what you understand?
Yeah, that's what David Sampson, team president, said at FanFest the other day. And, you know, keep in mind, this is year six at Marlins Park, and they were kind of hopeful back in 2012 when the park opened that they would have a naming rights deal. That never came about. The All-Star game, of course, is at Marlins Park in July, and they're hopeful, you know, that something could be done. I thought what David said was interesting because he kind of shed a little light on the subject, saying that there were three different possibilities, and they kind of want to get the deal right because it's a long-term type of deal. And as noted, you get naming rights, that's additional revenue that goes towards payroll and all the things that make teams as competitive as possible.
And then the TV deal is interesting because we've seen so many teams around Major League Baseball sign new deals for the TV rights, big, big money deals that have really been able to kind of jolt their spending. And right now, the deal the Marlins have down in South Florida is not that kind of deal, but it's also not up really soon. So how is the team approaching that?
Yeah, I mean, quite frankly, they have the lowest revenue of any of the 30 teams in terms of their TV deal with Fox Sports Florida. That contract expires in 2020, but they're hopeful that something could happen by the 18 season. Now, why this is important, I think we noted it a couple of months ago. Giancarlo Stanton, I think, is making $14.5 million this year. His salary goes to $25 million next year, and it goes from there between 25 and 30 or whatever it is. And not only just Giancarlo, there's a lot of salaries that are going to escalate, you know, in 18 and beyond. So this is a big year for the Marlins on a lot of ways for this core. And, you know, without a more competitive TV deal, I don't see any way they're going to be able to retain a good number of pieces on this roster. And as you know, that would make it more difficult to add pieces if their roster is short as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if a deal happens sometimes this year, but there is no, you know, no timeline. There's no drop-dead date. You know, we saw the CBA get done at a deadline. That isn't exactly the case with the Marlins and their quest for a TV deal. You know, with the deadline technically is 2 or 3 years from now. And, you know, they're hopeful that, you know, they want to be good partners with Fox Sports Florida and that they recognize the importance of, you know, doing something to make the team a little more competitive and take it to the, you know, the next level.
There were also reports over the weekend that there was a handshake deal to actually sell the Marlins. Now, a handshake deal, whatever that means when it's just coming through rumors and speculation. I guess I just want your thoughts, Joe. Is that something that we could see, or do you think it's just that speculation and it's a report that shouldn't get too much traction?
I don't dismiss it. You know, there's smoke, there's fire, right? And we're in a very lucrative industry in Major League Baseball. And Tim, I've been hearing, and I think most of the people around the team, you kind of hear some speculation for about a year now that, oh, after the All-Star game, Jeffrey could be open to sell. So I wasn't exactly surprised to see these reports. You know, now we're apparently getting names, you know, of possibilities. That should be interesting. But I wouldn't be shocked either way. I mean, again, you know, like I said, this is a lucrative industry. Jeffrey Lurie is 76 years old, and the time might be getting close to right for him to at least weigh that option. But, you know, the team isn't really saying anything publicly other than you do get approached from time to time. Actually, David Sampson said about 12 times a year or once a month, you know, literally somebody might, you know, approach them about, hey, are you interested in selling? Because people want to get into this industry. But, you know, this isn't going to be a Jeffrey Lurie decision. Jeffrey hasn't spoken on the topic. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if at least, you know, some people are kind of lining up and maybe some preliminary or more type of talks have already occurred.
Obviously, these are huge money deals that take a lot of time to iron out for sure. And just because there's that speculation doesn't mean there's anything happening anytime soon. All right, so to get away from the business of baseball and onto the on-field action of baseball, let's focus in a little bit on this Marlins outfield because, hey, it's an exciting one when you look at it all the way across the board. You get a start in right field with Giancarlo Stanton. You mentioned it, the money's going to jump here in a couple of years, but here's a guy who, I mean, how much of this team's success in 2017 is squarely on the shoulders of Giancarlo Stanton?
Oh, Tim, without question, a lot. I mean, this guy has the richest contract in sports history, and he has immense talent, immense potential. The sport, our sport has not seen anything like him in terms of, you know, the impact he does when he hits a baseball, yet he's been hurt. And, you know, he comes off a year that wasn't, quite frankly, very good. And, you know, they need him. You know, they signed him to that extension thinking they were getting an MVP caliber player. It's certainly all there. Giancarlo's has been as frustrated as anybody over that, you know, he hasn't had the full season. You know, even in abbreviated seasons, he hits 27, 28 home runs playing a half a year or so, and it just makes you wonder what will he do when he's on the field consistently. And, you know, he's, you know, without question, the biggest, you know, X factor this team has. He's got to become the Giancarlo that they're hoping. And, you know, he's a great person. He works very hard. He's a guy I think the industry wants to see be really good because he's one of the faces of the game when he's playing at a high level. So, yeah, clearly, you know, this guy made the commitment to remain in Miami, and it'd be a shame to see him not, you know, live out that contract and have to leave primarily because, you know, he's not producing at the numbers that justify the dollars.
And as you work your way around the outfield, obviously so much pressure on Stanton. Then you have Christian Yelich, who really came into his own a year ago. And he's the guy that's, I guess you could say, on the doorstep of being kind of a superstar type player that maybe doesn't get that appreciation around the league, but I know he does get it in Florida.
Tim, he's the best player on this team. He's the best baseball player. Stanton is the most impactful and the guy who could basically turn the game upside down. But Christian Yelich not only is the best player in the Marlins, he's kind of scratching the surface on being one of the better players in the National League. And, yeah, you know, the power was the last thing to come. 21 homers, 98 RBIs last year. He just turned 25 in December, and he's already been a 300 hitter. He's already been a Silver Slugger winner. He's already won a Gold Glove. And this might be the year he also adds All-Star to that. So an exciting player, a guy that, you know, is kind of still unheralded. Baseball people know who he is. Those who follow the data know who he is. His on-base percentage has always been ridiculous. And he would be a really interesting guy to be, you know, up there with Stanton as one of the faces of the game as well. And he has the temperament, the personality to be that. And he's an exciting guy to watch no matter how good or bad this team's doing. You can kind of bank on Christian Yelich being right there and being a reason why you're watching that game that night.
And then Ozuna's an interesting guy, Joe, when you look at the last few seasons. 2014, when he was just 23 years old, kind of broke onto the scene. He hit the 23 homers. He drove in 85. And then 2015, kind of a dip. He missed a little bit of time in that season. But then last year, he was an all-star at 25 and right back at it. And at times, he looked dominant. At other times, he wasn't quite there. So what does 2017 hold for Marcell Ozuna?
Yeah, he's one of those really interesting guys. Is he a 30-homer guy, or is he a guy that's going to be between 15, 20 and kind of disappoint you? He was a starter in the All-Star game last year based on an incredible first half, and he carried this team in the first half in many ways. He hit over 300. He hit, you know, I think, 16, 17 home runs. Second half, though, Tim, on base under 300, batting average low 200s, and the power number's not there. So, you know, who is he? Is he as good as he was the first half, as bad as he was the second half? I can tell you this, he's an energetic-type player. He's exciting. He has a ton of raw power, and he's one of those guys who just smiles every minute he's on the field, and he loves playing baseball, and he's a guy he's easily, you know, people cheer for. His teammates love him. And it's also a big year for him because he's now in arbitration. So, you know, his dollars are going to go up. And, you know, this guy, is he a long-term contract extension type of guy? Or is he a guy that, hey, they may need to look to leave, to move on after this year if it doesn't exactly go the way they hope? But, you know, the trio overall, Tim, Marlins feeling as good as any. I mean, what the Mets had three guys, if you count, you know, Bruce's Cincinnati numbers, they had three guys with 30 homers or more last year. The Marlins had three guys with 20, and I know Citi Field's not the easiest home run park, but Marlins Park is tougher than that. And, you know, power doesn't come easily. And if these guys were all 25 to 30 or more, they got a pretty good, outfield. And they all play pretty good defense as well.
I was going to say, when you add in the defense, it's clearly, I think, a better outfield than they have with the New York Mets. And it's tough to find. If those guys are what they could be, if Ozuna is his first half self and if Stanton's healthy all year, hard to pick a better outfield in all of baseball. Boston is probably up there in the discussion, but certainly a great outfield. And when those guys aren't in, you have Ichiro back again for more. And it's going to be an interesting year, I think, Joe, because last year was all about the numbers for Ichiro. I know not in his mind, but as far as fans go, watching him kind of chase down history, all that pressure's kind of off now. Do you expect to see maybe a different Ichiro? Could he be more laid back this year?
Ichiro was a great story last year, without question. At 42 years old, to get that 3,000 hit, to hit at 300 or right around, you know, for most of the year, and just to kind of prove to people he wasn't completely done. Key with Ichiro now, he's 43. How much more? And you just love him for the game. You know, he's a future Hall of Famer. He clearly likes being part of the Marlins. Don Mattingly's challenge is to find that proper balance where Ichiro is playing but not overplaying, maybe two starts a week. You know, a guy has to miss a couple of days because he's a little nicked up. But you have to monitor that playing time with him because he just simply can't, you know, go out there 5, 6, 7 days, you know, for very long and produce. And that's when you see kind of the wear and tear or the age, I should say. Still, when he topped 500 stolen bases last year, he got to that figure, to 3,000 hits. I think he really was trying to prove something. Now it'll be about just proving that he still can be a productive big leaguer. And, you know, obviously every time he hits a milestone, I'll be reporting a lot about it, and it's fun to watch. And it's, you know, Ichiro has always been to me one of those reminders of why you love baseball. You know, yep. This guy is an international icon, and, you know, and he's loved in Miami. Obviously loved throughout the industry and the game, and clearly back in Japan. So you just don't want to ever see that come to the end. And you just, I think early on in spring training, we'll kind of get to see how he looks. You know he'll come in shape, and you know he will give it all he's got. Just at some point, though, when is all he's got to finally the end?
And hopefully we don't see that drastic decline on the field. Hopefully he continues to be a productive player as long as he's playing the game because he's been so great. All right, well, if the Marlins are going to be great in 2017, we know that outfield will be a big part of it. Thanks, Joe. Great stuff as always. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Marlins edition. For Joe Fusaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with Mark Bowman, our MLB.com Braves reporter. And the Braves are reporting to Florida, to Lake Buena Vista, Florida, of course, outside of Orlando. Pitchers and catchers have reported. Mark, first impressions, I guess, first of all. We're going to get into the infield a little bit to finish off our roster breakdown. But you've been there for, I'm guessing, about a week or so now. First impressions on how everything's coming together near Disney.
Well, you know, there's certainly a different vibe in this clubhouse. You know, that has something to do with how the Braves finished last year with their winning 20 of their last 30 games. And it also has something to do with the changes they made during the offseason. You know, they feel the need. During that 30-game stretch where they won 20, their starters' ERA was 5.19. Then they go out and add three veteran starters, so they have some more stability there. I'm not going to say the Braves are in a win-now mode, but at the same time, based, you know, compared to what they've done the last 2 years, the moves that they've made have given the players a sense that, hey, look, this team certainly wants to be competitive. And they're not just saying that because, you know, you had a a big setback this past weekend. You know, as recently as Friday, the Braves are expecting Sean Rodriguez to play a significant role with this team, and not only be their primary second baseman to start the year, but also fill in a lot of different positions with his versatility. But John Popolelli got a call around noon on Friday telling him that Rodriguez's shoulder was much worse than they anticipated, and there's a chance that he misses this season. You know, we still haven't got confirmation on that, but he is going to miss a significant part of the season. So 2 days later, they trade for Brandon Phillips. You know, I don't think that everyone had assumed that was dead. You know, that those trade talks were dead when Phillips vetoed the trade back in November. But now they went out and got a guy that's, he may be on the backside of his career, and it may not be the player he was, you know, during his All-Star years, but at 35, he's still, you know, a decent defender who's he'll be able to provide some, you know, production in the middle of that lineup, and certainly more than you might expect to be able to find at this time of year when a sudden need develops like that. So I think there's certainly a confidence, a lot more confidence around here. This time of year, you hear everybody say, oh, we can win, but, you know, when the Braves are talking this year, it seems a little bit more genuine.
Great transition there, right into the infield. As far as Phillips goes, Mark, the deal, he vetoed it, obviously. When you look at the trade on paper, the Braves didn't give up a whole lot. They're not even going to have to pay him much. The Reds picking up the majority of the contract. What was the difference maker? Was it the fact that they allowed him to keep his no trade clause? Was that the biggest deal for Phillips as far as saying, okay, I'm willing to go basically home to Atlanta where he has a home?
I think that helped. You know, I think that, you know, obviously the situation in Cincinnati was not a good one. The writing was on the wall. Had they even brought him to camp, it was apparent that they wanted to play Peraza. They weren't going to continue to try to trade him. Or, you know, certainly he may not have started. He may not have even been on the team. You know, I know Mark Sheldon said that there was a chance they were going to release him. So you look at that as a player, you got to feel wanted. You know, you can say, hey, look, he should have been feeling that back in November. The writing might have been on the wall there. You look in November as well. You know, the Braves made this attempt to get him before they signed Rodriguez. So the same opportunity that exists now exists then when he vetoed the deal. So, yeah, I think that there was a little bit to had to do with the Braves giving him the $500,000 bonus if he does get traded, you know, because he still has that partial no trade, you know, list within his contract. So if he does get traded, I think that $500,000 might have helped. But at the same time, maybe the timing just was right where, you know, you start looking at, you're staring at the possibility where you're a couple of days away from camp. And instead of going to a situation where you're not necessarily wanted, you come to a place that not only, you know, do they suddenly need you, but you know, the guys around here seem to be looking forward to the opportunity to play with Brandon and see what he has left.
Maybe some irony there that Jose Peraza was one of the factors involved here. Obviously, the former Braves prospect who then went over to the Dodgers and then eventually to the Reds. So you got Phillips at second. Obviously, Freddie Freeman is at first. You have Dansby Swanson at shortstop. Garcia over at third, we assume. As far as Phillips and the no trade, one more thing on him. There could be a time this season where the Braves decide Ozzie Albies is ready to go. So I would think even though they have to pay out that extra money and there's a, you know, no trade clause to a degree for Phillips, if Albies is ready, they're going to put him in there, right?
Yeah, again, you know, when Ozzie's ready, he's going to be a couple of weeks behind here in camp, with his rehab from the fractured elbow. So, you know, in anticipation is, or the hope is for right now that he'd be ready there in early April to play with Gwinnett at the AAA level. And, you know, I think everyone gets the sense that he could benefit from at least a couple more months at the minor league level. You know, let's say they get to June or July and it's apparent that he's ready. He wasn't too far off at last year. They may have to make a move. At that point in time, you have to base that on what Brandon Phillips is doing at the plate. You know, do you ask him if he wants to play third? Did you make some other adjustments? You have to, you know, obviously that's influenced on what Garcia is doing over there at third base as well. Or, yeah, you make the trade. But for right now, there wasn't an apparent need at second base. So they bring Phillips in. You know, there's a chance he ends up spending the whole year in Atlanta. But Albies will be a guy to watch, you know, throughout the year because, you know, when he's ready, they are going to try to get him up here because, you know, for at this point last year, the assumption was that, you know, Albies would be at second to start this year and Swanson at shortstop, and then you'd have your double play duo of the future together. You know, Albies is still just 20 years old, so there's no reason to rush him, especially coming back from this kind of injury. But when the time comes and he's ready, he'll be here.
Freddie Freeman's going to be playing in the World Baseball Classic for Canada. He's coming off a season, Mark, where if the Braves were a better team, maybe he's in the most valuable player in the National League discussion. He had that kind of season. He seems to be right in the smack middle of that prime. Is that what you expect to see again in 2017?
Yeah, I think last year was a very important year for Freeman. I mean, look, he's had some good years here during the early part of his career, 2013. He played a key role, and you look at what he did last year, and his numbers ranked right up there with Seager and, you know, all the other top players throughout the league in terms of WAR and weighted runs created. Plus, you look at all of them, those numbers, he was right there. And I voted for him. I put him fifth on my ballot. And I thought that he certainly warranted that. But you're right. He had the Braves had a winning record or been a playoff team. I think you would have seen him get a lot of top three votes last year.
Dansby Swanson. We got to see a taste of Dansby in 2016, and he did not disappoint. He looked every bit what we thought he was going to be, which is a team leader, a guy who can get it done at shortstop, also at the plate. Is this year all about dealing with the adjustments because you know they're going to come from pitchers around the league?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you have to anticipate sometimes, you know, they'll make some adjustments. He'll have to make them as well. You know, he got 6 weeks at the big league level last year. You know, it was right about that point in time. You know, that kind of gave everybody a better sense of who he is. I mean, I don't know if you can anticipate he's going to hit 300 just like he did during those 6 weeks last year, but he's a pretty cerebral guy with a rather simple swing. So, you know, yes, there will be some more growing pains, and he'll have to make adjustments throughout this year. But, you know, this guy is, you know, his mental approach is every bit as impressive as his physical attributes. So, you know, I think, you know, the anticipation is he'll be able to make the adjustments, but it's all part of the process, and it's not always smooth.
We mentioned third base and Garcia. I don't know if that's a long-term plan or not, Mark, but how comfortable is that position for him right now?
Well, you know, you look back at last year, how he started the year, and he was he was on pace to be one of the worst defenders ever at third. They sent him to Triple-A Gwinnett to play left field, to learn how to play left field. He doesn't spend any time at third base. He comes back up and doesn't spend any time in the outfield. Suddenly, he's at third base. Or, well, let's put it this way. He's a serviceable third baseman at that point in time. He doesn't, you know, he's not as much a liability at that position. If he can play defense like he did late last year and continue to provide the kind of offense that he has, you know, since he arrived as a majors there during the latter part of the 2015 season, then yeah, he can you know, he can be a guy to fill in that spot on a regular basis. But I think you're going to see Jace Peterson play the position at times, especially against some tough righties, maybe where they want to sit with Garcia. You may see Chase Darno get some time there. You would have seen Sean Rodriguez there, but, you know, that's just one of those many positions where the Braves are going to have to make some adjustments, and they are fortunate that Peterson and Darno both have the kind of, you know, similar versatility to Rodriguez. They don't have the pop in their bat that Rodriguez is going to provide, and they're not the kind of weapon that he would have been against left-handed pitching. But at the same time, you know, at least from a versatility standpoint, they can do a lot of the same things he was projected to do.
Great stuff, Mark. That'll do it. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Braves edition. For Mark Bowman, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here, along with Todd Zielecki, our MLB.com Phillies reporter. Pitchers and catchers have reported to Clearwater. In fact, they're working out today, Tuesday, as we record this podcast. We will get into the bullpen a little bit. That's another spot we have to hit as we break down this roster a bit, Todd. But before we get to that, I know Andy McPhail spoke before spring training officially got kicked off as well, and seems like he's very pleased at the direction of this franchise right now.
Yeah, he is. He sees a lot of potential with a lot of these young players at the big league level and at the minor league level. And I think he also very much likes the fact that the Phillies, they added some veterans this offseason, but they added veterans on one-year deals, which kind of sets them up nicely for future off seasons, and you know, maybe even earlier than that if a team is looking to ditch somebody at the trade deadline. You know, Phillies, because their minor league system is so deep, they could actually maybe add up some salary that way. So overall, you know, yeah, he likes the direction of his team, although he acknowledges that, you know, he needs to see more progress. You know, he needs to see more of these minor league prospects, you know, continue to progress and take a step forward. And he put it best yesterday. It's kind of a numbers game. You know, you know, every prospect is not going to pan out. So you just hope that the more prospects you have, it gives you a greater chance of having a few of them pan out. If a few of them pan out, then I think they set themselves up pretty nicely going forward.
You have an article on Phillies.com today about Zach Eflin and the fact that he's actually got healthy knees, which you don't usually have to say about a 22-year-old, but he's just kind of had to deal with this in his life. So what does that mean as far as ceiling for Zach Eflin if he's been able to get to this point on these unhealthy knees with the chronic pain? How excited is he to kind of look to the future?
He's very excited about it. You know, he had surgery on both his left and right patellar tendons in his knees last year, you know, August and September last year. And, you know, he basically says that he's had knee problems for the last 10, 12 years. You know, even in the off season when he wasn't pitching, he said he'd wake up sometimes and his knees would be sore and he'd feel some discomfort there. You know, I asked him today, I said, you know, how much do you think that affected your pitching? He declined to say. He said, I don't want to make any excuses. And I kind of followed up and I said, well, how much, you know, do you have any idea how much you could improve your pitching? And he says, you know, it kind of remains to be seen. But he did say the biggest difference for him is when he's kind of gliding towards the mound, his left foot, left leg is going towards the mound. He can really put some weight now on his right leg, his back leg, and which will maybe kind of let him explode the ball a little bit more towards the plate. So, and if that is the case, maybe that means he gets a little bit of an increase in velocity. If not an increase in velocity, maybe it just makes him a little bit more effective in one way or another in terms of his mechanics go. So it's going to be really interesting to see what what Zach Eflin can do on two healthy knees. Because like you said, he's been pretty successful with bad knees. So you wonder what he's going to be successful with good knees.
Amazing, yeah, that a guy goes to the Major League Baseball with bad knees throughout most of his life. It is kind of amazing. All right, let's get into this bullpen a little bit, because I don't know if there's any real roles that are locked down as spring training opens up here, but let's start at the closer and work our way back. A year ago, Todd, it was Genmar Gomez doing that job pretty well for a decent amount of the season. Does he have the inside track on being the closer, or is a guy like Hector Neris going to push him? Is this a competition?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question, because we just got done talking to Pete Cannon, and he basically offered that Genmar Gomez right now is his closer. He sees him as the best guy for the job, and which is a change in December at the winter meetings. He basically said we really don't have a clear-cut guy, a clear-cut closer, so there could be a competition in spring training, which I personally agree with, because I think Hector Neris has the best stuff as a closer. But, you know, Pete is going to give Genmar Gomez every opportunity to close, which I guess I also understand in the sense that he did save 37 games last year. So, you know, he should have an opportunity to see if he can continue in that role. So going into camp as of today, Genmar Gomez is going to be the closer. Although I never rule out anything at this point. If Genmar Gomez really struggles in spring training, or he struggles really poorly the first week of the season or first 2 weeks of the season, I definitely can see Hector Neris moving into that role.
Yeah, he may be looking over his shoulder a little bit. So if Gomez, as of now, is the closer, then you look at that setup man. Neris is an obvious guy. How about Edubre, if I get that right, Edubre Ramos? Is he a guy that could fight into the late innings?
Yeah, for sure. Both of those guys, Neris, obviously, you know, if you're talking about a guy as a closer, then if he's not going to be a closer, then he certainly qualifies as a setup man. And Ramos, they think, quite frankly, that he has closer stuff, he has closer potential, although he's a lot younger than, I guess, some of the other guys. So for that reason, he's a sixth, seventh, eighth inning candidate. And then, you know, they also signed Joaquin Benoit on a one-year deal, and he's pretty much spent most of his career in the setup role. So at the moment, I don't know who the favorite would be to pitch in the eighth inning if Gomez is the closer. I would say at this time it would probably be Benoit or Neris, with the other guy then sliding down in that seventh inning role. But really, if we get down to it, they're in a much better situation than they were last year, because last year they had all these non-roster invitees in camp, and you know, they went into the season not knowing who was going to close. It was going to be David Hernandez. That didn't go well. The next thing you know, they go with Genmar Gomez, who last year at this time was a six-inning middle reliever, and they just had no options. So at least going into this season, they have three or four guys that, you know, in a pinch could close for this team.
Then when you look out how the rest of that bullpen goes, you have a Pat Neshek, you have a Joely Rodriguez. How does the rest of the bullpen, I guess, shape up in your best estimation? Because obviously spring training will tell a lot of this. But is there a guy to get lefties also?
Yeah, you know, the four righties we mentioned, obviously Gomez, Neris, Ramos, and Benoit are locks. Pat Neshek is a lock. They acquired him in a trade with the Astros. He's going to fit in somewhere. So those are five guys that, honestly, right now, if everybody is healthy, I would take it to the bank with those guys on the opening day roster. I really think that those guys are safe bets. Now you have two spots left over and no lefties yet. So lefty-wise, I think there's three options. Two of them are on the 40-man. Joely Rodriguez, who you mentioned. Adam Morgan, who started last season for the Phillies, moved into the bullpen. I think he has a shot to make the team as a reliever in the bullpen, possibly as a long man. And then Sean Burnett, who's a non-roster invitee, had a lot of success in his career, but recently he's been, you know, he's recovering from two Tommy John surgeries. If he can pitch effectively in camp, I could very much see him making the team as another left-handed option. So those three guys, you know, again, early, very, very early, but those three guys, because they're lefty and because they don't have no other lefties in the pen, to me have a really good shot at making this bullpen.
Then you think of other names that could kind of battle to get onto that roster. And there's intriguing names there, like Mark Appel, Dallaire Hinojosa. You know, what's the rest of the competition, I guess, like as far as depth of this bullpen?
Yeah, you know, Hinojosa is interesting. Last year at this time, I was saying that I could see him closing for this team, and he actually was a legitimate candidate to close, and then he got hurt early last season and never made it back to the big league. So a strong camp by Hinojosa could, you know, maybe create an interesting conversation. Luis Garcia throws hard, but for whatever reason, he just hasn't been able to put it together at the big league level on a consistent basis. So guys like that, I think, you know, with a very strong showing this spring, could maybe change some minds. So, but overall, their depth is so much better than it was last year. I'm not saying they're going to go out and light the world on fire, but I do remember that first week of the season. The Phillies were in Cincinnati. I think they blew their first two games. The bullpen blew the first two games of the season, and it was like, who is going to get anybody out after the seventh inning? I mean, it really looked bleak at one point. And then finally, some of these guys, you know, became a little bit more comfortable and enjoyed some success. But I don't think they're going to be in that situation this year, the first week of the season, because the depth is so much better.
And that can be so demoralizing for a rotation that has some young arms on there that they kind of need to get that lift in the late innings sometimes for their confidence. So how much can a good bullpen just even help that staff as well?
Oh, huge. You know, I remember years ago I was talking with Dallas Green, who was the manager of the 80 Phillies team, and this is right after the Phillies got Billy Wagner from the Astros in spring training of 2004. And he said, for his money, he said, the closer can be one of the most important jobs in the team, despite the fact that they only pitch an inning. He said it is just a killer for a team night in and night out to go out there and watch your bullpen blow a lead, you know, especially on a team like this that's going to really have to fight for runs. And for a young pitching staff, young starting rotation, at least in those three of those five spots, to not be able to hold on to leads late can be crippling, and you want these guys to enjoy some success so they learn how to win, they learn how to handle success. And if you don't have a bullpen that can do that, that really kind of sets you back. So, it's going to be big for them to be able to hold this lead, because I've seen it happen before many times where a closer is struggling and the rest of the team is kind of looking around like, what can we do to win the ball games? This is killing us.
Good stuff, Todd, and it's going to be reassuring for sure to see some talented arms coming out of that bullpen throughout 2017. We will continue throughout the spring with the podcast to get you ready for the 2017 season. For Todd Zielecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Thanks for tuning in to MLB.com Extras, our Phillies edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.